Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio, and it is April 30th, 2011. Nice sunny day here in Ottawa this week, pretty tumultuous week through the states, and my sympathy and empathy goes out to the people across the states who suffered from the terrible series of tornadoes across your country. There's so many kind of threats these days in our environment. It's really quite startling. And the ongoing Japanese Fukushima irradiation is an ongoing concern. So we're facing, it seems, so many problems all around the world these days. It seems at times like the rate of catastrophes or chaos is upping more and more at times, or getting more intense. So today I'll bring on my co-host right away because we have been exploring Beelzebub's tales through the last couple months, but we've spread it out quite a bit. But we want to continue to move through explaining some of Gurdjieff's classic book today. But I'll bring co-host Jim Moffat on from Toronto. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Okay. Have you had any more time to be reading the tales?
Just a little bit. I've been sort of working my way very slowly through them. But I have been reading them. I've been looking a little bit at your book, too, at the earlier version of The Slugs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, I got through to the end and have submitted all the changes.
Oh,
good. So I'm waiting to see a revised, like, PDF of it, and then I'm going to review it once more. I'm hoping it'll be available, like, within 1 to 2 weeks, actually, but I'm not sure Zalchka has had time to work on it recently. I'm looking at an additional 60 to 70 pages added to it, so it's a very significant addition to the book. And even now, I know, like, about 4 more chapters I would add. Like, I hope in a year or two, maybe to do a third revision on it and have it really completed then. But it's kind of exhausting, I bet, doing it. It's taken me 4 months, you know. So much going on in the world, it's hard to focus at times. I meant to mention I had an email after our last show, and from John Francis, our friend in California there, and John corrected me on he mentioned 3HO in association with Reach and Moy, who we were talking about, and he reminded me, 3HO was Yogi Bhajan.
Okay.
Yeah, that wasn't Sri Chinmoy. I forget what Sri Chinmoy's group called themselves. I thought they had some name, but I'm not really sure. And he also sent me some links about, just links to material about Sri Chinmoy and his kind of sexual involvement with students. Seems to be an occupational hazard for these gurus who come over from the East.
I was reading about Adidas and kind of he seemed to have really gone off the deep end in some significant way in terms of the sexual misconduct and sort of perversion that amongst his followers, and it was very bizarre actually what happened with him. Are you familiar with that at all? Have you ever read
it? No. Can you share some of that?
Well, I don't really know that much about it, so I don't really want to get into it, but I know that I was reading, like, Ken Wilber is very much, like, promotes Adidas.
You're breaking up a little bit on the phone. I'm not...
I can barely hear you, too, actually.
I can... Oh, yeah. Okay, now it's okay.
Okay.
So Wilber refers to Adidas quite a bit, does he? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He regards him as being, the most important contemporary teacher and really pushes his work, but then was really quite dismayed. And I was reading on a website about Wilber's reaction, because from my understanding is that near the end of his life. Like Adi Da had supposedly had these kind of orgies where he had students engaging in all sorts of kind of strange sexual activities and directing them to do this. And it just sounded like, I'm thinking, like, this can't possibly be in any way explicable or, you know, right. It's like, it sounds very strange to me. And you know, I mean, there's been several people, like the Swami's Muktananda also, there was charges about him and sexual misconduct with his pupils also. You know, it's interesting.
And Yogi Desai.
Yeah,
I've heard the similar of. I mean,
yeah,
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it just seems like it's so at odds with what they teach and their understanding of things and these brilliant expositions of things and you know and unfortunately it also undermines the credibility of these teachings, and people, skeptics, can jump on this and say, well, look, you know, these people are just, you know, they're just like anybody else. But I mean, I think in some ways that they're not just like anybody else, but when you see them fail like that, I mean, it's very hard to square, like Adi Da's claims about, you know, about his being an avatar with kind of this like perverse behavior. It's very disturbing. I'm not really sure what to make of it, you know.
It's hard to judge. You talked of him as though he had passed away. Is that
true? Yeah, he's dead.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
That was a bit of a shock to me. I thought he was still down there in Fiji or somewhere. I think he's
with Fiji, right? That he went to. No, he did pass away
within the last couple of years.
I don't really know for sure, but I think perhaps about 2008 or something like that. I think it's relatively recent. That's why I knew that there was this thing that Wilbur that had some, you know, real conflict with, in terms of, because he had promoted his work so much. And then I started sort of looking on the internet just for material on Wilbur on Adi Da, and then I found this reference to you know, this whole, all of the scandal and everything. I'm just on the internet now, just to see if I can find his dates, like Adi Da, when he dies. Adi Da died, November 27th, 2008.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but...
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, and, you know, like, you say how Wilbur discusses Adi Da's work a lot. Does Wilbur ever kind of address what Adi Da says, like Adi Da elaborates the heart, the doctrine, or he calls it differently?
Wilbur's written a lot of stuff, but I've never seen, that's what I find peculiar, I've never seen an exposition in his work, and I've read a fair amount of his work. Certainly, like, he's very prolific, so, you know, I don't want to say that he hasn't addressed this, but I was really struck in reading one of his books, The Marriage of Sense and Soul, when he was talking about the importance of sort of the discovery in modern science of the brain and how it's the brain's functioning, and how this was completely unknown in previous times to people in the mystical and esoteric tradition. And I realized that there's no real statement in his work that indicates any kind of recognition of the heart doctrine, which I find very peculiar, you know. And it seemed to me, just in that book that I read, that he was really elaborating the head doctrine and or at least was tacitly subscribing to the head doctrine. I was quite shocked because, as you say, like an Adi Da, there's such a brilliant exposition of it, and it's like it's there for sure. So, yeah, very peculiar.
Yeah, I would have thought Adi Da, apart from my own work, is the writer who most made the effort to elaborate the heart doctrine concepts in terms of modern science and psychology.
I agree.
Actually, he's like, often I say, I'm like one of the few or only kind of people arguing this idea that consciousness and the I experience originate out of the heart. And I think, I'm like one of the main people promoting that. But Adi Da, really, in modern times, did articulate that. Yeah.
And very much had a very, I would say, like an integrated perspective on it in terms of the ancient teachings and his personal experiences and modern scientific knowledge about the physiology of the heart. Like, he's very specific about how he describes it. It's like there's nothing nebulous or metaphoric or illusory about it. He's very specific about what he's talking about.
That's something that Ali Da passed away. I'm sorry to hear that. I kind of imagined meeting him someday, or I'd wanted to send him. I think he would have appreciated my books, which quote from him and give some overview of aspects of his work as well.
It's funny because in the book that I'm writing about the problem of God's contracting universe, at one point I sort of outline how you initially began to discover the heart doctrine in various esoteric and mystical sources, and I make some commentaries about different quotes from different people, sort of explaining that this is in so many different traditions, and then I talk about the enigmas that within modern science about the initial spark within the sinoatrial node and what that mystery about, you know, where life comes from and how the heartbeat actually starts and then I talk about some other aspects of the zero point teaching and everything, and then I was thinking, like, you see, in the following chapter I wanted to elaborate a little bit on the idea of the heart doctrine because I just sort of present the overview, and I was looking at material and trying to figure out how to approach it. And I had two thoughts. One was that just to again cite, like, how, you know, when you were compiling this, is that within the various traditions that you looked, you saw over and over again all of these different traditions elaborate the heart doctrine. It's so startling when your attention is drawn to how this is in all these different traditions, very, very important. And then the second point, I was thinking, well, like, what are the best kind of explanations of it? And I was really struck by, like Adi Da's material, I think, is the best elaboration of what it really means. I think the most concise description of this and analysis of it is in his work.
Yes, especially enlightenment of the whole body is excellent for that.
Yeah.
I remember reading that back at the same period as studying the Bhagavad Gita, and which clearly explicates the heart doctrine. And I liked in Adi Da, his autobiography is very interesting. And I like how he describes when he was young, he had an experience of what he called the bright. And the bright, in my understanding, in a way, what it was an experience of the bliss sheath. And he experienced that kind of bliss sheath within himself, and he labeled that the bright. And then he describes in his autobiography, like, he kind of grew up with that awareness. But then as he got older and went and studied in different areas, it was still there, he describes it, but he kind of got away from it, like the mind was exploring all these other realms. And then it wasn't until later, till he had some of his next experiences of enlightenment, that it kind of reawoken that experience of the bright. And yeah, it's a neat way of talking about it, because I think I would say that we all do have that bright within ourselves, and we kind of lose awareness of it, and it's in our essential awareness, and then through our life we have to recover it. As Gurdjieff says, it's like a second education. It's like the first education, in a way, is information and theories of the mind, and you have to develop that side of yourself, but then Gurdjieff emphasizes you have to kind of break that down and get back to the awakening of the higher emotional center for Gurdjieff, but which I would identify with the heart.
How he says, I like that the metaphor that he uses is that in a sense this is essence, that little child lives in its essence, but then through contact with the world and through education and enculturation and socialization and just being in the world, personality develops, and that's useful to a point, but it grows like a crust over essence, and I think that really kind of captures that. And so you lose that contact with you become insulated from being in your essence, and so your essence doesn't grow, and you lose any kind of semblance of experiencing that directly and acting from that directly. You more interact through the world through your conditioning and through your education and through your socialization processes, and I think that's really actually a very, you know, apt description. Like you say, I think a lot of little kids have these like higher experiences when they're young, but then they disappear. And also, like I was reading about people recalling past lives and how common that is in little children. And, you know, reading about Ian Stevenson's work again and how that it's quite common, but, you know, it's like you just forget because you're conditioned, you know, to you're filled up with all this other information about things and you're no longer kind of in that essence and you're more in your personality.
Yeah, and then we have to recover that again.
And the Adi does even. I mean, his description of it is really even more dramatic because he has this higher, more intense realization that, like you say, of being in the bliss sheath, and still he becomes identified with his ego and with the subjective processes of his personalized ego and identified with the body and identified with the world, and he sort of loses that for a period of time in his life. It's a very interesting dynamic that he describes.
Yeah, fascinating work, and he has very profound descriptions of some of his mystical states and additional concepts. He has an original understanding, he calls it the regeneration of the it's like regeneration of the Amrit.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Forget the term.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to leave it. I'll try to review it and come back to it. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear Adi Da has passed away. Wow, that's really something. Yeah, and it does seem to be a widespread kind of hazard of these gurus, I guess, especially when they come from the East, where they're probably more traditional values and they're not allowed that kind of sexual freedom, or it would be frowned upon more.
Yeah.
I mean, I've also heard negative reports about Sai Baba. And I don't know
really?
If these are true. Yeah, people claiming that he was involved with children sexually and
really?
And again, like, I don't know if that's true, but that's sometimes I think people can try to discredit some of these people by making such claims. So we need to be cautious talking of it. Still, it's still there's certain inappropriateness. I mean, at least with someone with Rajneesh, like, there was someone very sexually active, but at least he was honest about it. And he seemed to encourage that among his students. But then I think that draws people of a certain bent, that they're sometimes drawn into these kind of cults because of the availability of sex. And I met some people from one of these churches. I forget which one it was, Church of Infinite Love, or one of these kind of groups, and they actually, that's how they brought people into their group, was by having sannyasins who were kind of willing to make themselves available to kind of bring people into their group. We'll discuss that a little bit today when we get into Beelzebub's tales, because he has a very interesting section about, like, our overemphasis on our sexual vices and kind of the perversion created in modern society, which he traces back to the Greeks, which we'll come to in a few minutes. But anyway, okay, so Any other notes before we pick up with Beelzebubs? Can you? We've got. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that a few weeks ago, I mentioned a few weeks ago that I sort of come to this place too in writing about I'm trying to try to deal with the question. It's like one of the things that skeptics and disbelievers say about religious teachings, and by extension, they would say this about mystical and esoteric teachings if they understood them, but I don't even think most of them understand them, but is that they never make any predictions about anything that, you know, that science has been able to corroborate, and that they never, there's no kind of consistent explanation of things, and that's, I mean, obviously that's just completely wrong, but even more importantly, I was thinking like specifically about the idea within physics about the probably the most extraordinary discovery in 20th century physics has to do with the recognition of the existence of non-locality in physics and how somehow time and space are transcended, or there's faster than light communication, or nobody really can understand it. And I was reading again about Bohm Bohm talks about how physicists tend to really ignore the implications of what quantum mechanics suggests about the nature of reality. He says they sort of work within a safety zone or a certain framework where they can explain things, but they don't really sort of grasp and address the implications. And I mean, one of the implications is, does the concept of non-locality suggest? It suggests that somehow there's some sort of transcendent realm or some sort of higher dimension in which time and space are collapsed or that they don't exist. There seems to be some indication of that. And then when you look in the mystical literature, what you see is that people have throughout the ages have provided these explanations of experiences where they experience non-locality directly. Like in Yogananda's description of cosmic consciousness, that's a description of somebody who's transcended space and time. Like he sees worlds being born, like crystallizing out of like this sea of infinite energy and light, and he sees worlds being born, and he's at one with the universe. So he's traveling faster than the speed of light in the sense that he's everywhere, and yet he's physically in one place. And I just think it's like when you really look at this with an open mind, and if you have some sort of grasp of what modern physics is saying, it's like this is really quite extraordinary that people have described this. So it's ridiculous to suggest, there's nothing in mystical or esoteric teachings which would have anticipated or predicted anything that science of significance that science has discovered, because it's precisely the opposite is true. It's like what you detailed in your work, Madame Blavatsky was talking about point source singularities and many of the same dynamics that modern physics and cosmology discusses in explaining the origins of the universe. She was doing this over 100 years ago. So it's completely ludicrous to suggest that mystical and esoteric teachings don't predict things that science has since substantiated or come to describe in similar terms. But I think the really extraordinary one, the more I think of it, is just this whole idea of non-locality.
Yeah, very much so. It's so interesting in completing my book on Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, she at one point says there is no action which is local. Action, she says, ultimately everything is non-local.
And I think that's what Bohm, wouldn't Bohm say that too, don't you think?
Yeah, it follows. Yeah, everything, because everything is implicated through the implicate and super implicate orders. So everything is interrelated through the implicate and super implicate order. So it does imply, everything is non-local. I mean, it's an illusion,
it's just
locality.
Like all of this is kind of the bubbles on the surface, but the root, it's rooted into these higher dimensions where all of the Cartesian coordinates just don't exist. Like everything is collapsed into this higher dimensional reality where everything is interrelated and interconnected, and it's just completely distinct from how we understand things in a, you know, the external time-space grid of, you know, of our four-dimensional world. It's just so fascinating, as I say. When Bohm is really interesting when you read him, because he had written a textbook on quantum mechanics when he was, where was he? I think he was, oh, he was at Berkeley. It was the Livermore Laboratory at Berkeley. And he sent a copy of his book to Einstein and to Bohr, but he never heard back from Bohr. But then he went to Princeton, and he actually became quite conversant with Einstein. Einstein was very interested, but he was sort of recognized as an expert on quantum mechanics. And, you know, really nobody really understands quantum mechanics. That's the bottom line. But what he emphasizes over and over again is that both relativity theory and quantum mechanics point to the interconnection of everything, of wholeness, for precisely different, precisely the opposite kind of reasons. Like they're not the same reasons, but they both point to the same thing, is that the connectedness of everything. And that's what sort of set him off on this quest to try to develop a theory which would explain this. And he's really articulate and really interesting when he talks about how really, despite all the success of quantum mechanics, because it's practically been successful, eh? It's allowed us to do all sorts of things,
yeah,
technologically. But he said people really haven't come to grips with what it really says about the nature of reality and in the nature of the physical universe, that it has to be, there has to be these transcendent realms. And I find that so fascinating, that even like these, you know, like these guys who are, you know, the most prominent physicists in the world really haven't come to grasp the terms with and grasp the significance of quantum mechanics. And, you know, it's been around 100 years now.
Mm-hmm. And it's like they go about their daily business and kind of just ignore this kind of huge philosophical conundrum that underlies their whole approach.
That's exactly what Bohm says. he had some great phrase. I wish I could find it again. I remember reading it, but he said they go to the office and they're wearing his hat, you know, and there's all these huge questions, and then they go home and they're just kind of, you know, like they're back in the normal, you know, the normal world where everything adheres to like the logic of the time space, you know, coordinates. But they said there's so much beyond that reality that they haven't been able to deal with at all, which is so interesting.
Mm-hmm. And
but again, going back to what I was saying earlier, the interesting thing is that mystics have reported experiencing these higher realms directly and give explanations which are entirely consistent of what they experience. Even though they say that words can't describe it, they do. What words they do describe things in, what they're pointing to is a non-local reality, which is so interesting that, you know, this has been going on for thousands and thousands of years, and people have been having these experiences. So clearly, the nature of our consciousness is implicated in our understanding of different levels of reality, and you know, some of the limitations that we experience in terms of trying to explain things scientifically are imposed by our level of consciousness. Like we try to translate things, we try to describe the whole in a language which breaks things up into parts, and it's impossible to do. Like Gurdjieff says that at one point, it's like it's impossible to reconstitute the whole in normal language, because it's based on premised on the division of things into all these different parts, and so the task is to try to describe the whole, beginning with a language which is based on parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another important concept, I think, too, is the notion that there's like what they call like third force science, which recognizes, like, traditionally science has had this dichotomy of matter and energy, and kind of conceived of the universe. Everything's composed of matter and energy. But what's emerged out of quantum theory and the new holographic theory in physics is the idea that there is third force, and that third force is not material. Well, it is material as well, and it's also energetic. But mainly, that third force is intelligence or information. And in science, that is dimensionless. So you can have like unlimited amount of information within space, and it doesn't kind of take up the space. So you can have, you know, vast information fields latent within space itself, but would appear to be nothing to us. So I think Michel Talbot, in his book, The Holographic Universe, emphasized this idea of third force science, where intelligence and information is, you know, supplements the traditional duality of matter and energy. And we see that, like, I think it's fascinating how in the yogic Vedic philosophy, you have the three gunas, or the modes of nature, which are sattva, rajas, and tamas. And sattva stands for light, mind, information. I would relate it to information. And rajas is the energy principle, energy or passion. And then tamas is the mass or inertia principle. So in Vedic teachings, they say everything in nature is is composed of the three gunas in different phases, modifications of the three gunas, which is exactly what modern science has arrived at, is that, you know, you can consider things in a material or energetic way, but the third approach is the information aspect. And that's what we have in modern quantum physics, is this realm of information and mind. And that's third, fourth physics. I've got it this week. I'm supposed to complete part four of that article series I've been had published in the Journal of Esoteric Studies, the online journal. If people want to see that journal, it's called esotericstudies.net. And in the latest issue, I had part three of my article series. And the part one was on the elaborating the idea that of consciousness and the I experience originating out of the heart rather than the head. And then part two of the series was all about the notion of how we have these zero-point centers, and the different meanings of that, different concepts. And then the part three was towards a towards a holographic metaphysics of the human heart. And it was kind of based on Yogananda's experience, which I recount, and how his consciousness expands to embrace the universe. And at the end of his experience of cosmic consciousness, he says, he was drawn back into his body, and he says, a point of intuitive perception within my heart irradiated splendor to the whole universal structure. That somehow through the interior dimensions of his own heart, he was related to the whole of the outer universe. And that's what we find in mystical teachings, is the idea that there's a holographic physics to the human heart, and that it's a multidimensional entity. It's not just a physical heart, but is said to be a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and ultimately a divine source emanation, like a God spark or a spark of holiness. And that is said to be within the ethers of the heart. So it's a conjunction of a point source of light within the ethers or space of the heart. That's supposed to be the origins of human consciousness. And the part four, which I've got to I'm trying to work on at the moment, it's actually trying to take the newer concepts in holographic physics about how black holes in an alternate space dimensions, the activities of black holes can be rendered equivalent to material and energetic processes on different levels of the ethers. So I'm going to try to develop this fairly complex article explaining how Blavatsky says, like, first there's one zero-point center, and then it differentiates into seven. And she says the cosmos is founded on these seven holes dug in space, or zero-point centers. In the human being, the way you'd think of this is, like, we have seven chakras, and each chakra has two aspects to it. It has the radiant circular rotational aspect on the periphery, but each chakra has that central point, which is the energy or that chakra's kind of infinite aspect to that chakra. So each chakra has like a central zero point, and they all originate out of the heart chakra. So I'm going to try to develop an explanation, trying to explain how that's related to these new concepts in physics of how black holes in higher dimensional space can function as information processors. And that's the notion in physics, that a little black hole can be the ultimate information processor. And in a way, that's what Blavatsky's saying. She says that the spiritual intelligences on higher dimensions, their information and mind is brought down through zero-point centers, and it informs material energetic processes. Anyway, that's going to be hard to write that article this week. It's a very speculative article, but it's trying to develop a model of holographic consciousness based on Blavatsky and the new ideas in physics. It's what's in my book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which we've talked about a bit before. But it's hard to, it's such a good, useful task for me, I find, to try to condense and distill this information into article-length pieces of writing. So, anyway, I'll send that to you this week, Jim, and get your comments on it.
Yeah, the journal is it's actually the School for Esoteric Studies, but the journal is actually called the Esoteric Quarterly. It's published by the, or it's presented.
And
by
I think it's available at isn't it esotericstudies.net?
.net, yeah. Or you can just put in the Esoteric Quarterly, and it comes up too. Both will lead you to it. Good journal, a very interesting journal actually.
Yeah, high-quality journal. I found that, too, yeah.
And then, that's it. Like, that was another example. Like, I would say one of the primary examples is, like, in mystical and esoteric teachings, is the teachings of three gunas and the Christian Trinity and the Law of Three and the Gurdjieff Uspensky and the three hidden splendors in Kabbalah all point to this exactly this that now that is being recognized in modern physics is like the Trinity. It's not just matter and energy. It's matter, energy, and intelligence of some sort that really underlies everything. And I mean that's an example of something that the ancient teachings have talked about for thousands of years and would have predicted. And now in modern physics, that is being more and more recognized as being central. It's like it's being, it's sort of on the cutting edge of the development in physics. It's interesting you mentioned Michael Talbot's book, The Holographic Universe, because I just started rereading that recently because I wanted to get some more background information on Bohm and on Carl Priebram and in the holographic paradigm. So I ended up rereading the book. I'm almost finished. And I read that book when it came out 20 years ago. And, very good book, very interesting book. But I had completely forgotten so much of it, So it was very useful to reread that book. A lot of very interesting things. And he talks about some of his own personal experiences, too. He's a very interesting guy.
Yeah, he had a series of valuable books, but that one particularly, it was almost a classic, I would say.
Yeah.
In the modern writings, like The Dancing Wu Li Masters or The Tao of Physics, which were kind of classics in that era.
Oh, I think this is, of those books, I think this book is actually even more advanced. I mean, the Tao of Physics is very interesting, but I think this is even, in some ways, I think this is even more important. I think it's sort of the next step. I think the Tao of Physics sort of paved the way for everything that came after. I don't really like the Dancing Wu Li Masters that much. I don't think it's I think it's kind of overrated, my own feeling about it. But I really like Talbot's work. I think he's very interesting.
I wonder if he has anything more recent.
I meant to look him up to see, is he still kicking? And what's he writing these days? Because, I would have thought that he would have produced something else by now, but because this was 1991 when he brought this out, and I would have thought.
Oh yeah, 20 years ago.
He had so much material, you know, in that book. Like, it's quite exhaustive. Like, he has a lot of interesting discussion about paranormal phenomena and all sorts of things. About the chapters on the body are very, very interesting. When he talks about holographic realities with respect to the human body, very, very interesting. And like the capacity of the mind to heal and to direct energies and to create sort of its own realities.
I've always felt that I think there's possibility of self-healing if we could be in touch with our zero-point center. And it's like bringing our consciousness into that subtle field that underlies the body, the kind of primordial level, and then, in a way, regenerating the body through that. There's so much we don't know about healing, but I think that people sometimes, what we see in spontaneous healing is this kind of regeneration that can occur from within without. I mean, I think generally healing occurs in a way from within without. It's not brought about by external means. Instead, there's that innate wisdom or intelligence in the body. And if we can connect to that, I believe we can regenerate ourselves. And
he talks about that in the book and about the etheric level and how some people maintain that really everything that happens on the manifest physical level is really being informed and being directed on the etheric and the subtler levels of the human body. I think there's a lot to that, really. Like, it goes again. It recognizes the fact that there is nothing permanent in the physical constituents of the physical body. Everything is in flux and in transformation and transition, and is being informed by some sorts of fields of intelligence that lie beyond the physical. I just, you know, I don't understand how people don't recognize that. You know, it just seems to me like it's such a basic fact of if you just look at what we know of the physical body, but yet, you know, you can practice medicine without acknowledging that at all. It's very peculiar in a sense.
It's a shame. It seems to me modern medicine in a way became so predominated by the use of petrochemical pharmaceuticals, you know, and this whole there's been a suppression. I mean, I think you see that more and more today is the governments are trying to, like, restrict people's access to health products and health therapies, and which is really very unfortunate. And they say now that modern medicine is the third leading cause of death. We're having that in Canada, is these restrictions on people's health care freedoms, which is really quite terrible.
Yeah, the other side is that people do live longer than they ever did before. And it's like, you know, and part of that is modern medicine. I mean, there's a lot to it. That, you know, there's a lot to these drugs that do work. But I think the model is somehow fundamentally flawed. And I mean, obviously, that you have the pharmaceutical industry, which is this multi-billion-dollar industry, which controls and is very powerful politically, and you know, exerts ridiculous influence not only on governments, but on what's researched and what questions are asked and where funding goes, and you know, I mean, it has enormous implications for all aspects of health provision and health care. You know, like, I mean, I think there are a lot of things in modern medicine that are very progressive and you know, are quite brilliant, but there's a whole piece that's missing because it's sort of all rooted in this model that I think is very much incomplete. It's very much like the situation with consciousness research, where there's all sorts of interesting research done on the brain and the mind, but it's somehow fundamentally it's rooted in the wrong understanding of things. It's it's dealing with a part, but it's not really dealing with the whole, and it's really not dealing with the most essential aspect of the whole. So, you know, it's all sort of on the wrong foot somehow. And then, there's all of this enormous pressure and enormous influence because there's so much friggin' money involved, you know?
Yeah. I think modern medicine, like, there's no denying its advances, particularly in terms of, like, emergency care, what they can do now, like to reconstruct, you know, broken bones and the methods of surgery. Like, that is so advanced.
You break a leg, you know, I think you want to go to a hospital and, you know, be treated by, in terms of modern medicine. It's a good way to, you know. They're very good at doing certain things, but they're very bad at doing other things, you know.
It's more in the treatment of systemic problems, I think.
Yeah.
Problems that are rooted in maybe allergies, toxins, nutritional deficits, and such that they can't deal with because they don't consider the whole of a person and their lifestyle and nutrition and that. It's in that area. It was amazing. I went out with some friends to, we had a local politician, the Liberal candidate for our local area, and I went out as trying to do some truth activism sometimes, so I thought I'd go out and meet this lady and ask her about some of my concerns. And what I did was I had taken a lot of photographs of the chemtrails spraying in Kempville. And I put a bunch of the pictures of this chemtrail spraying. And when you see the pictures all together, it's like, it's pretty shocking when you kind of just see the pictures. So I took it out, and she, you know, she was saying, how the Liberals are concerned about the environment, you know. And I kind of gave her these pictures,
What did she say?
Well, she couldn't believe it, and says their main excuse is, it's condensation trails, which is such a shallow kind of response, because it's obviously not, you know. I've lived, when I was in cars there, I was right across the river from the airport, and I'd see airplanes all the time going up and down. You never saw them leave these huge, huge kind of white streams behind them. Most times the jets have just nothing behind them. There's not even condensation trails. Or if there's condensation trails, it's only for, you know, 100 feet or so. It's completely different than these chemtrails. And the planes that lay the chemtrails, they're not flying to the airport. Like, the airport's one way, and these go back and forth in the sky. And sometimes they turn off the spraying. But anyway, it was funny because going out, like, to me now, I think that this chemtrail, the main ingredient, has repeatedly been shown to be aluminum. And when I was out there, and we had another couple who came out to kind of support us and be part of what we were trying to do, and we were talking, and it turns out the friend David, he had three seniors in his family, and they all had Alzheimer's. And my dad had Alzheimer's, and then the lady, his partner, she had one parent with Alzheimer's. And then the person, it was like everybody's got Alzheimer's. So many people have elders in their family with Alzheimer's. I'm going to research it. I think this is a very, very serious problem. I just look up now, and I think they're giving everybody Alzheimer's. You know, I'm going to do research. I'll report it next week. I want to find out about the statistics on the incidence of Alzheimer's now. But I'm just shocked. I mentioned it here. There were a few people here last night. And again, there were people here, and they had parents with Alzheimer's. It's so widespread. I'm quite shocked. I want to research it further. And see what the current research and thinking is on Alzheimer's. I mean, I'm sure there's different theories of it. I know traditionally they identified aluminum as one neurotoxin that could cause Alzheimer's. I don't know what they attribute the recent rise in Alzheimer's to.
My understanding is that they don't really know.
what causes it,
That's what they say. Like, they just don't know.
Yeah. I think there's competing theories. And it may not just be a singular cause.
People were talking about aluminum and Alzheimer's 30 years ago. I remember that very well. And then, you know, you get people who dismiss it and poo-poo it. But that's true of everything. I mean, you know, any explanation, I mean, you'll get people on both sides, like the whole thing about additives in inoculations and how that relates to autism. Well, the one thing we do know is that the autism rates are skyrocketing around the world. I mean, it just they are. Like, I mean, there's no question about that. The question is, what's causing it, or is it multiple causes? I mean, one of the things you could say about Alzheimer's probably is it just because people are living longer. That's part of it. Like, I mean, they just are. People are living much longer than they used to. So there's a certain amount of natural. They used to call it senility, so there's that. But I would say it's probably there's probably 15 or 20 things in the environment with all the chemicals that we ingest and all the toxins that exist and nobody that's the other thing, nobody really knows what all of these things do in combination. And most of the studies of toxins are done like they're isolated, but nobody really knows what these things do in combination. So if you have one thing that sort of depletes an essential nutrient and then allows, you know, the negative impact is something else, that's sort of the double whammy. And I suspect that some of the neurological problems that we see, like everything from Alzheimer's to learning disabilities and autism, I suspect that those things are generated by a number of different things, not just one thing. I'm just guessing. I mean, I think that's probably the case with most cancers, is that they're, you know, there are multiple sources for the disease. Like, that's why it's so hard to sort of track it down. I mean, cancer is a good example too. I mean, I think it's probably mainly environmental. You know, I just think the rates are so incredibly high that it has to be environmental. Many cancers have to be environmentally induced. You know,
We can't have a simplistic causal model thinking, oh, there's just one cause, like for Alzheimer's. Yeah. Like, there's bound to be, like, there are different neurotoxins. So aluminum is a neurotoxin. So is mercury, formaldehyde, you know, different neurotoxins. Or other different nutritional, like aspartame, which they were saying causes brain... I think infarcts, like obstruction of brain vessels. I think they were talking. They talked about Rumsfeld's disease. I think it was called in the States, because Rumsfeld is the person who kind of pushed through the acceptance of aspartame.
Oh, yeah.
And there's supposed to be so many people with that brain damage by aspartame. It would be a complex process to kind of weed it apart, like the different contributing factors. Cancer, we wouldn't expect all cancers. Yeah. Like cancer in one person might be caused by poisons through smoking, whereas another person it could be exposure to radiation. Another person it could be poisons through the inoculations. You know, there's different. We can't
there's a lot of different things. But, you know, one thing that I mentioned this, I think, a couple of programs ago, but they found that the number one preventative for developing Alzheimer's is in people over, you know, 55, 60 years of age, is regular cardiovascular activity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You want to get more blood and oxygen to your brain, basically. That's really, apparently it's quite dramatic too, that if you exercise something like 3 times a week for more than 30 minutes after, I don't know what the age was, I think it was like 55 or something, it might have been 60, that's really, like, really critical, because, you know, that's what's happening to you, is that you're getting less and less blood and oxygen to your brain as you age, you know, and so that's a big thing too. So I started walking a lot more, a lot faster. You know?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, getting older myself, I don't want to have Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I don't either.
I'd like another 30 years, because I still have all kinds of interests and reading and want to experience things and see what happens in the world. I don't want to lose my faculties. It's really quite tragic.
I can live with I can live with the fact that I'm falling apart physically, you know, and I mean, I have some issues from arthritis, from playing hockey and injuring myself, back and neck issues, but I certainly don't want to lose my faculties. That's what I'm most concerned about, you know, is I want to be, I want to be writing for another 25, 30 years. I'm 61 years of age, you know. I plan on, you know, I think that's the worst thing. I think it's the, you know, that it's the very difficult disease to have, you know, because it's just so, there's such a lack of dignity in it, in a sense, like that they call it.
Yeah, it's very sad in that way. I find that too, because it's like here, you know, you have an elder, and in through the last years, like they get to the point where they don't even recognize their family members.
Right.
My dad fortunately didn't get that bad, but I mean, my dad during the last years of his life, it was, you know, going to the bathroom, to the bed, to eating, and he had no interest. He even stopped watching TV, which he watched too much through his life. But he didn't even have interest in that. He's like, you know, he couldn't remember things for longer than 30 seconds, kind of. In a way, it's a very tragic process. I mean, I don't think it's as bad as autism in young children. Imagine that, like, what the demands put on a family with an autistic or retarded child, handicapped child. You know, it kind of takes over a parents have a child, and if it has autism, what that signifies for their life in terms of time and resources, and it's so hard on people. I know I was at the used store the other day and saw these nice two young looking men, and then I heard them speak, and right away I could just see, oh, that's vaccine damage. I could see they weren't autistic exactly, but you could see there was some, I don't even know how to describe the kind of deficit, but it was just like I could just see it. Oh, that's vaccine damage. I mean, I don't know that it was. That just came to me. And it's kind of nice-looking young men, but as soon as they talked, you could see that they were obviously, I'm not sure, I don't think they were retarded, but it's something eccentric. It was funny because we went out, when we were inside, and then we went outside, and I'd put my bicycle where he put his, and he came over to inform me that place is where I put my bicycle. And then he told me, well, that's okay for today. I'm not mad at you. It was so funny, kind of, you know. He was sweet. He didn't, you know, but he couldn't understand how someone else could leave their bicycle in his spot. Like, it was reserved for him. But he told me I could put it there if he wasn't there.
Oh, nice.
It was sweet, but it just saddened me, you know, kind of these young people. So many people. In Kempville, we seem to have a lot of kind of partially disabled people who are in kind of community living type arrangements. You just see it more and more. I see it more and more. The kind of...
I wanted to... Are you getting that echo? I'm getting an echo. Are you getting that echo?
No, not at the moment.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask you a question about the heart doctrine, and you've explained this a little bit before, but I'd like you to explain it again. I remember, the heart doctrine is in almost every esoteric teaching, but it's not. It's explicitly in Gurdjieff's Fourth Way teaching. I mean, I think it's there, but it isn't, and it isn't explicated the way it is in other teachings. And you said that in Beelzebub's Tales that you think it is in one place, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, great. I'll read the quotation from the Tales. It's where Beelzebub is explaining that how we have, like, three... brains, and he's explaining, like, the head brain, and then he says the second brain is, he says the center of it is the nerve nodes of the spinal cord, So the spinal column. So that's the second brain. And then he comes to the third brain, and he says, this is, I'm just finding the quote here. He says, in the beginning, these three-brained beings of the planet Earth had this concentration of the emotional center similar to us in the form of an independent brain localized in the region of what is called breast. Okay, so there, what is that independent brain in the region of the breast? So he doesn't actually label it as the heart, but I would say that's what he's referring to. But he doesn't use the term. So it's like, well, why doesn't he say the heart if he means it?
Yeah.
But anyway, he's saying in the beginning we had that as that independent brain in the region of the breast as our emotional center. But from the time when the process of their ordinary being existence began particularly sharply to change for the worse, then nature was compelled, without destroying the functioning itself of this brain of theirs, to change the system of its localization. That is to say, she gradually dispersed the localization of this organ, which had its concentration in one place in them, into smaller localizations over the whole of their common presence, but chiefly in the region of what is called the, quote, pit of the stomach. The totality of these small localizations in this region, they themselves at the present time call the solar plexus, or the complex of nodes of the sympathetic nervous system. So what he's suggesting is, originally, the way I would interpret that, originally the emotional center was the heart, the independent organ in the region of the breast, but then it was changed to the autonomic nervous system, of which there are different plexi in the body. That the solar plexus is the largest plexus, I believe, of the autonomic nervous system. It's just below the diaphragm, and people feel a lot of anxiety and fearfulness in the solar plexus. I'd say it's the major center for egoic emotions. Now, here's another. I had another quote from Gurdjieff. This is a comment in Beelzebub's Tales, then, he doesn't explicitly state that the heart is the basis of the emotional center. As I described, an independent brain in the region of the breast. Gurdjieff, in Views from the Real World, notes, there do exist inquiring minds which long for the truth of the heart, seek it, strive to solve the problem set by life, try to penetrate to the essence of things and phenomena, and to penetrate into themselves. So there he's saying, people longing for the truth of the heart.
Right.
And it's funny, in other literature on the heart doctrine, like in the Bhagavad Gita, it's like what Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. And there it's like, it's very explicit that everyone has this kind of spiritual self or spiritual spark connected to the heart. But in a way that would be, I think Gurdjieff's emphasis so much is that people don't automatically have a soul, that they have to attain it. And I think Gurdjieff, in a way, wouldn't want to have endorsed the view that, everybody has this kind of spiritual self in the heart, and we'll all come to that and realize it at some point, and it's there for all of us. He had a different emphasis. He was saying, we have to attain our soul. We have to make efforts to awaken and attain self-consciousness. So it's a different emphasis in ways. And also Gurdjieff, he says, most people, we live in the state of waking sleep or sleep, and that people need to attain the next level of human evolution is attaining self-consciousness. But he explains then that people think they already have self-consciousness, but the self they are conscious of, in a way, is the false self connected, in his view, to the formatory center in the mind, in the head. So, and Gurdjieff says that it's like we have to break down that formatory mind and get back to our essence. And I think he regards the heart as the center of the essence in a person. I mean, that's like in that quote, it's like get, you know, the truth of, we long for the truth of the heart. Does that? Yeah, it's a very different emphasis in Gurdjieff. He doesn't.
Well, I think you're identified. Like the really critical thing is that because there's such a different emphasis, because he says there's nothing permanent, like there's no permanent soul, and that really we have the potential of acquiring a soul, but that it requires work on our part. He wouldn't endorse just the heart doctrine as it's articulated in other teachings. There's many aspects of the fourth way which are very different from other esoteric teachings and have a different kind of emphasis on things. And I think that's actually probably the most important one, is this idea that we don't have a permanent soul, according to him, and that it does depend on our existence, and that the work we do here is important in terms of acquiring a soul, or, as he says, to become immortal within the limits of the solar system, and that is a very different emphasis. So it's very interesting what he says. He also, like, later in his earlier teachings, like as you described, from Views from the Real World and In Search of the Miraculous, which were talks and lectures that he gave in the 19s and the 1920s. Later, when he was in Paris and in America, he seemed to shift his emphasis in his talks with people, and he talked a lot about having the I am experience and experiencing it in the breath, like not saying it subvocally, but to try to feel I am and to feel it in your chest. So I think in a way, like, that is actually an articulation of the head doctrine, of the heart doctrine versus the head doctrine. Eh?
Yeah, it would correspond with it. Yeah, even his last book is entitled "Life is Only Real When." Whoops, good.
When I am.
Yeah, when I am. Yeah, yeah. Only real then when I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I am awareness. Yeah. That, so he, I didn't know that he identified that with the heart area. I mean,
yeah,
it follows.
I see that in some of the later talks, or that there's some books out of his later talks, that have been gathered by. I'm trying to think of who. There's a book, transcripts of Gurdjieff's meetings during the war, and I think that was brought out by William Patrick Patterson was the one that had access to these papers. You know, he had that group of women in Paris, and Celita Solano, who was one of the women in that group, her papers were made available, and I think that's where a lot of these talks have come out. But it's very different the way he talks to people in his talks during the war. But I noticed that's come up several times, and I was reading Ravi Ravindra's book about his work with Madame de Salzman, and she seemed to emphasize that too, about feeling this feeling, that strengthening this feeling of I am, and how important that was, you know, and to try to connect your feelings with your body, and I think, and the emphasis again is to get out of your head and to try to change the localization of your center of gravity more into your heart and into your body, but more like to take it out of your head and move it back into your heart. It's kind of interesting too, because, like, I don't know who it is, maybe it's Bennett or it might have been Raj that talks about at the beginning when he's talking about the Beelzebub's tales, and Gurdjieff talks about how the two bodies split off from the earth, and one became the moon and then the other became this secondary moon that we can't see. It's kind of that's symbolic. I mean, that one interpretation is that's what happens to human beings, is that, you know, you have these three centers that are all one, and then two of them split off, and one of them sort of becomes a shadow and really doesn't even recognize its existence properly. And I think that's essentially what he's saying about the heart. Like, I think we, you know, we identify with the mind and the body, but we forget about the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about the third center.
Yeah, and then at the same time, it's fascinating how intuitively I think people identify the heart as their self, where people even talk and they say I, and they kind of point to their heart area to indicate themselves. They do it intuitively. We know that the heart, there's some mystery to the heart. And also, Gurdjieff, he emphasizes in attaining the state of self-consciousness, he associates that with the opening of the higher emotional center. And so he never really tells you, well, what is this higher emotional center? And I wouldn't say it is the heart, because I think also to just say it's the heart gives a misconception, because it's not the heart as we ordinarily think of what the heart is. As a you know, mass of soft muscle tissue, it's his idea, like it's the spiritual heart, like it's this center that's even non-physical. So in a way, to say, refer to the heart in a way gives a misleading impression, because you think it's simply a material thing in the body, whereas the real heart center is something deeper. But
yeah. It perfectly makes sense, though, in terms of everything we've been talking about, is that you pass into the more subtle levels of your existence, and then you apprehend dimensions and higher realities that you can't apprehend in your normal waking state of consciousness, but that you have to pass into these more subtle levels of existence. And sometimes that happens spontaneously, but to really understand it, to achieve it, it requires like discipline and the following of some sort of esoteric path, and there's various ways of getting to realize these states. But that's what I think is the dynamic, is that you are passing into the higher dimensions of the heart. But as you say, it's not the physical heart; it's the higher dimensional subtle heart. So it's like there's different levels of heart, just as there's different levels of all aspects of our being, that there are these more subtle levels of consciousness that really rather than being generated in the brain by the neurophysiological processes of the brain, it's the other way around. It's like that these things are descending, these higher, subtler energies are descending and informing the physical body and providing the life principle and the consciousness to the body, and then we experience and we use the organs of the brain and of the heart and of the physical body which together create the intelligence of and life of the physical body. It's like we have things upside down, like the, you know, as Gurdjieff says, human beings perceive reality topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
I'd say that's true of our modern psychology and medicine, is that because we don't recognize these subtle levels, we don't really understand the nature of where life and consciousness originate. They don't originate in the physical. They originate in the more subtle dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah, another way that's expressed sometimes is they, like, life doesn't come from below.
Yeah.
Like consciousness and awareness isn't generated by material processes, but rather life and consciousness come, I would say, from within without.
Yes.
I remember Swami Prabhupada, who used to say, life comes from life.
Yeah.
Like you have this, he'd call it the jiva atma, the individual self, which he describes as smaller than like a spark or a small seed within the heart, and it's self-illuminating. And life in the body, life and consciousness originate from this spiritual element. So life comes down from above rather than being created from below. And life comes from life. life does not come from material matter. Matter is provides the vehicle or body for that life principle to be incarnated. So it's a very different understanding. Life comes from life, and it comes from within without, rather than being created by material processes.
And there again, that's a perfect example of how the ancient texts anticipate the development of something in science. Is that that's a holographic explanation of the relationship of the jivatma to the paramatma, and how we are similitude to the whole, as Gurdjieff says, would like that this individual spark, which is at the center of our being, which gives rise to our life and consciousness, is somehow holographically related to the great soul, which is identified with the universal structure. So in a sense, there is the whole is in the part, and the part is in the whole. The fact is that because we identify with the ego and with the subjective ego and with the physical body, we can't experience this splendor which exists at the center of our being, which is what Adida experiences, the bright, like the bliss sheath. And it's a perfect example of how something in the ancient texts does anticipate something that has been discovered and developed within modern science and technology, and somehow these holographic principles underlie the nature of reality, and yet people were experiencing this in relationship to their soul. It's so funny that people who deride or demean religious teachings and mystical and esoteric teachings have no idea how complex these ideas are that explain. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, you know, we were born with a soul, and when we die, our soul goes to heaven. I mean, that's one spiritual explanation, but there are much deeper and more complex explanations, as in something as well known as the Bhagavad Gita, which gives a very detailed explanation of the nature of life and consciousness, which I would say is much more sophisticated than that which exists within modern psychology. It's like when Roger Sperry, the Nobel laureate, says he doesn't see how there's any way to explain consciousness independently of the brain arising from the brain. But that's because he subscribes to a view of the universe in which everything is lifeless and there is no consciousness and there are no subtle dimensions. I mean, if you see the universe as just being this vast array of physical constituents which interact mechanically and which have no intelligence and there's no spirit and there's no animism, then then you have a real problem. But you still have the problem as of how does this transformation occur in the physical constituents of a human being's brain to produce life and consciousness. In a way, like it's more logical to say life comes from life than life comes from non-life.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, that quote from Sperry where he says, I don't see any way for consciousness to exist apart from a functioning brain. But at the same time, he doesn't know how the functioning brain produces consciousness.
Precisely.
It's just assumption. He doesn't know how the brain, so he doesn't know how the consciousness could exist apart from the brain, but he also doesn't know how the brain produces consciousness. So,
and it's so interesting too is that really there's this huge body of research now from the near death experience, which ironically has been driven by the development in cardiac resuscitation technology, which really shows that it is possible for consciousness to exist independently of the brain. And I think there's overwhelming evidence for that. And I think anybody who really looks at that literature with an open mind, and there are various people who have done such research, like, as you mentioned, Michel Sabon, the French cardiologist, and Kenneth Ring, the American psychologist, they spring immediately to mind. Actually, I believe Raymond Moody initially started his investigation. He was skeptical. And they've all come to realize that this is This is a real phenomenon, and it can't be explained in terms of our current understanding of the brain. And it's so interesting because, again, this is another area where people's experiences of higher mystical states and transcendent states of consciousness describe exactly what people describe when they die, like they, you know, encounters with beings of life and beings of light and getting information and having a transformative experience where you no longer fear death and where you realize that you have a realization of the essential all rightness of the universe and experiences of these higher levels where love seems to be everywhere and there's this radiant light. I mean, that's been described in mystical experiences for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And yeah. if you had said 50 years ago, if we develop a technology where people will be pronounced dead, but then we'll be able to bring them back, what do you think they'll describe? Well, everybody in modern science would have said they won't describe anything.
Yeah.
They'll be nothing because they won't be conscious. They won't have any conscious experience. But mystical esoteric teachings that say they'll experience what I just described, and that's exactly what they do experience.
Yeah.
It's so peculiar, right? Like, I mean, I think it's the most important body of evidence established within modern medicine, which sort of undoes the whole model of the physical body and of our understanding of the nature of consciousness. I think it challenges everything in terms of our conventional understanding of things. And
I think it was that body of research, which we both studied, it was almost 35 years ago, that really convinced me, like, not to do paranormal psychology research, because I realized, like, holy smokes, how much more evidences could we possibly have? What more can be provided? Like, there was a whole series of books of serious researchers documenting these claims. Yeah. So I thought, the problem isn't, like, we have enough evidences to have a working assumption that consciousness isn't produced by the brain and that there's some spiritual or soul or something other. What that was became the mystery, like how it does work. But I agree with you. I think that's the most convincing body of research establishing paranormal reality. I mean, there's all kinds. I mean, you see it when you look at the recent book where the fellow reviews, he did the conscious universe,
Dean
Radin.
Yeah.
His work's very good because he just shows it's overwhelming. It's not just that there's out-of-body and near-death experiences. There's also all this evidence for PK and all this evidence for psychical phenomena. Like, you put it all together, and he did meta-analysis of different areas of psychical research. And it's like, holy smokes, there's more evidence establishing this basic premise of the possibility of consciousness existing apart from the functioning body. There's, like, overwhelming evidence for that.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because, I mean, he compares, like, some of the correlations that exist in when you do these meta-analysis of huge bodies. Like, what he's doing is he's not analyzing individual experiments, but he's looking at groups of experiments and doing statistical analyses on these groups of experiments. And what he points out is that if you look at some of the correlations involved for phenomena such as psychokinesis, these correlations are much stronger than, say, for the evidence that aspirin prevents heart attacks. You know, like, I mean, the correlation for that is so low, it's barely significant. It just meets threshold. And in fact, in the UK, NOVA, for some reason, they can't replicate those findings in the UK. Like, they hold in America, but they don't hold in the UK. Which is interesting, eh? But as he points out, like, the correlations are much stronger. And it's funny, like, in that's what I'd forgotten about the holographic universe, is that he cites that he's really done a really interesting job. Talbot has analyzed a lot of different books in terms of the history of psychic healing, and he talks a lot about stigmata phenomena and various aspects of the paranormal from a lot of anecdotal evidence, and it's very interesting. Like the depth of the analysis he provides, how much evidence he cites, which at the very least challenges our conventional ideas about everything, and it's quite overwhelming actually when reading. I was really kind of knocked out and just really amazed at how many interesting books he cites in his research. Mm-hmm. What he's trying to argue is that we have to abandon the conventional model and we have to move to a holographic model of the body as well as a holographic model of the universe and a holographic model of the mind, that it makes much more sense to pursue these models, because within those models you can start to explain a lot of the things that are inexplicable, which are regarded as being paranormal, but which in a holographic paradigm would not be abnormal or wouldn't be, or sorry, paranormal, but would be explicable because they go beyond the conventional understanding that, which is actually illusory about the solid physical body and the mind, which is limited to time and space. I was really quite struck in reading this book again. I was quite amazed how much I'd forgotten about it. That was the first thing, but just how much evidence he cites. It's quite amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll have to reread that.
Yeah, I would really highly recommend that you do. I think you'd be quite impressed by. There's several books there that I found that I would really like to find and read that he cites that talking about different phenomena. And again, like coming back, I just wanted to mention that you make a very good point, a very interesting point, like, which I talk about in terms of my book, which deals largely with your work and with your career. It's like when you approach the paranormal, like most of the research in the paranormal is to try to understand various aspects of it and to do experiments and to try to document things and to try to see if it's real. That's in many cases that's the objective.
Yeah, to establish a real effect.
If you take a more global view of it, as you say, kind of the near death experience sort of was a tipping point for you in terms of, it just becomes apparent that there's so much evidence that consciousness somehow can exist apart from the body, and if that's true, that changes everything. So yeah. I think it's really interesting what you did is that. Really, in all of science, what we're supposed to be doing is we make some sorts of assumptions, and then we proceed from that, and we formulate what's called the null hypothesis, and then we see if the evidence supports or rejects the null hypothesis. And generally, people approach all of these things from the same perspective, trying to see if they're real or not. But then what you've done is, like, it's really quite different, is just try to step back and say, well, let's assume. And I mean, we're making assumptions generally that they're not real. Let's assume that they are real. What would the dynamics have to be? How would we have to understand such things, such major topics as life and consciousness? How would we have to understand them differently to explain these things? And I think that's what's like so revolutionary about your work and your perspective to these things, because by looking at esoteric and mystical teachings, you've been able to develop a model of consciousness and a theory of consciousness, which is derived from these teachings, because these people have been asking these questions for thousands of years, too. And it's really all entirely coherent and rational and logical. There's nothing in it that requires anybody to think anything in any peculiar ways, per se. Like, you have to think differently, but there's nothing illogical about it. It's all quite logical and coherent. That's what convinces me that I believe it's true.
Yeah, me too. I'm the same way. Yeah, it is very logical. It's a scientific. The model can be formulated in terms of scientific hypotheses, and there's a it's not. What am I trying to get? The mechanisms of it are elaborated when we draw from the different religious traditions. But you see, scientists have kind of dismissed religions, but they always address religion as like a straw man. Like they you know, they say, oh, the book of Genesis, like how ridiculous, like God created the world in 6 days and or you know, people claim, biblical people say the world was created 6,000 years ago, kind of, and so it just proves how ridiculous religions are. And they have that kind of attitude towards religions, taking them on the most superficial basis and kind of disproving that. But they don't see, well, it's the esoteric side of religion. That's what we've explored. And that's very different, even from what people in different religions know about their religion. Like, I've not met Christians who really understand anything of the heart doctrine, even though I would say it's in Christianity. And I haven't met Christians who understand the principles of the laws of 3 and 7, even though that's also in Christianity. You know, or I've met Hindus, and they're familiar with the Gita, but they don't really comprehend that what Krishna says about the self within the heart, that's a scientific hypothesis. Doesn't mean it's right. And we don't just want to accept it on faith, but at least it's a scientific hypothesis. So we can try to draw out the implications of that, and how could we evaluate that concept. I think that's what's valuable, as you say, what I've attempted to do in my work, is to try to say, what are the possible mechanisms for these things? And I've avoided that issue of trying to prove to kind of disbelieving skeptics, which you can never prove anyway, because they're so fixed in their attitude from the very beginning. I mean, you see it when they do critiques of different paranormal studies by people. Their critiques are so sloppy themselves by scientific standards. Ad hominem attacks on people and misrepresentations of their work. And you know, I remember different books that came out that are critiqued by the PSYCOPS, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of the Claims of the Paranormal. And you just see the kind of sloppiness of their science when they're trying to disprove the research of Rhine or different paranormal researchers. And their work is sloppier than the original work.
Yeah.
You know, and they sometimes, another thing, sorry, but often scientists, like, they think if they can come up with another rational explanation for it, well, then you don't have to have a paranormal hypothesis. Like Carl Sagan says, well, I think near-death experiences are really remembrances of being born. And remember, he has that in his book, Broke His Brain, and how when the child comes out of the womb and the child is lifted up to the sky and he sees the light and there are beings there.
Flies up to the light, I think he says,
And the doctor is God, kind of, a God figure. So our basis of our spiritual beliefs is this kind of birthing experience, which is totally like... I mean, the analogies are so off because they're not, you know, a child goes through the birth canal. That's not just this kind of pleasurable trip down the tunnel into the light. You know, these are pretty kind of excruciating contractions and such, you know. But they offer another explanation, scientists, and then because they can come up with another possible rational explanation, they assume that that's true. But meanwhile, they provide no evidences that that is, in fact, the explanation. They think it's just enough to come up with a possible explanation, but not to substantiate it. So their arguments are just as specious and superficial as... the people they critique.
Well, and one of the standard things that they always say is that they invoke the principle of Occam's razor, that, you know, the most parsimonious explanation is the best explanation. And within reason, I think there's certainly something to that, but I think that really that completely falls apart when, if you don't recognize something that's essential and it's a hidden variable, then Occam's razor doesn't apply. And then when we're dealing with paranormal events, by definition, you're dealing with things that involve hidden variables and things that defy common sense. So that is... I think often like, what the argument is against from skeptics about paranormal phenomena is they just don't believe that they exist. And so they just really don't, as you say, like they grasp at anything which they think is even remotely plausible as providing an explanation and say, well, exceptional events require exceptional explanations. But realistically, that doesn't mean that dumb explanations are adequate. And then, really, like if you look at the near-death experience, like the standard explanation originally was anoxia, but that really doesn't hold up. What can't be explained about near-death explanations is how frequently people provide accounts which are from external to their bodies, like people who aren't sophisticated in terms of medicine can accurately describe conversations. They can describe procedures that they wouldn't have had any knowledge about, and very accurate explanations. I mean, this has been documented over and over again. It's not once or twice. This has happened hundreds, if not thousands, of times. So there's that problem. Then there's the quality of the experience that people are describing. It's like when people are born, they don't have an experience that they're in contact with a loving being and the essential all rightness of the universe. They don't undergo life reviews. I mean, I don't know of any birth experience where people describe that, but people do describe that when they die. And so really these are very superficial explanations of complicated topics. And the problem is that these people start not only with the assumption that these things are true, but with the faith that they're not true. Like that's where they're unscientific, is that they don't really have an open mind about these things. And as you say, when you read a lot of these explanations, it's like they're very weak. I would say too, like sometimes like in terms of like the comment I would make about a lot of the critics of the paranormal research, psychological research, is that you can apply that to all psychological research, because the simple fact is that when you're doing an experiment in psychology, it's hard to do a good experiment. Very, very difficult. And you can always pick apart an experiment and say, should have done that. Have you thought about this? Well, okay. Yeah. That doesn't invalidate the findings. It just means that you have to refine your experiments. I mean, I just think that that's true of almost everything in modern psychology. You could say, well, that's not really a very good experiment, you know? Like, so I don't really place too much importance on that. I mean, I think that's a valid criticism. I think that's a very useful criticism, but I don't think it invalidates the results of the experiment, per se. Because you can throw out basically everything in every psychological journal on that basis. Very hard to do a good experiment. Like a perfect experiment?
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking also, it's so funny because in psychology, in generally in personality and social research, you take a probability level of 0.01 or 0.05 is accepted as giving you significant results, meaning that the probability of your data coming out as they do are less than 1 chance in 100 or 5 chances in 100.
Yeah.
And so you take that kind of probability level of what's usually considered significant, and then you put that across from the statistical improbabilities from paranormal research, where it's not like 1 in 100, it's like 1 in 10,000 or 100 million, kind of huge probability against the results obtained simply by chance. So it's, you quoted a moment ago, I think, like Carl Sagan you were referring, where he says, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidences.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good point. I think that's true. But, I mean, I think there are extraordinary evidences. And it's like where they use Occam's razor. I think they use it, but they misapply it, because to me, it's like, what is more improbable? Like, to me, it's more improbable that there are all these people through different periods in history describing similar experiences and all kinds of cases where there's outside confirmatory evidences for people's claims. It's like to dismiss all of these things. That's more, in a way, what's most parsimonious is simply to admit, there's something in the person that can function and experience apart from the body. In a way, that's not so bizarre. Yeah.
It's funny too, because I had a personally an experience that always strikes me is that when I was 12 or 13 years old, I was playing football and I hit my head on the ground. And when I hit my head on the ground, I wasn't wearing a helmet, and people would say that would explain a lot, but I wasn't wearing a helmet, and all of a sudden, I was outside my body, like I had a perspective from outside my body, and I could see my head coming off the ground, rebounding off the ground, and it was, you know, like when they have the multiple exposure photography of like a tennis player or like an athlete doing some action where you see multiple
exposures. Or Duchamp's on nude descending the staircase.
It was like head ascending from ground, and I could see my head coming off the ground. Now, see, if you don't make any assumptions about anything, like I assume that because I was 12 years old, I didn't really have any kind of predisposition to anticipate this. I wouldn't have thought this was possible if you'd asked me. But what's the most parsimonious explanation of what I experienced? Well, the most parsimonious explanation is that somehow I was outside of my body. That's what the most parsimonious explanation is. If you
you think you experienced is really what happened.
If you say, well, it caused some sort of a hallucination or an illusion, that really doesn't explain anything. That's just a word to say that, he experienced something that's out of the normal. Like, I mean, it absolutely explains nothing. So I say, in that particular example, that the most parsimonious explanation is outside of my body. Well, there's a huge amount of research which would substantiate the idea that people can't have a perspective of their body outside of it, and you know, people in wars have had that experience. People under stress have had that experience. Extreme stress. People have had that experience in near death experiences. People have had that experiences in accidents like I had, where they're involved in sudden trauma. It's very common, and I would say, like, you know, that the onus shifts is not to explain. It's not to explain that what I was experiencing wasn't real. It's to explain how is that possible. Like, you know, I would take your perspective on that, and I'd say the evidence is overwhelming that people can exist apart from their bodies and have consciousness apart from their bodies and can have a perspective from outside. I mean, I didn't even mention out-of-body experiences that people report, you know, have reported for thousands of years. So that's where the onus shifts. It's like, how do we explain this? How do we have to understand consciousness to explain this? And that's the whole gist of everything that you and I have been doing for the last 35 years. And it turns out, well, there's actually a huge literature on this which explains it. It's called the mystical and esoteric literature. And it's quite clear about it. There's nothing misty or insubstantial or irrational about it. It's all quite rational. It's all quite coherent, and it's actually quite brilliant. And it's based on a science of consciousness and being, which these people have developed over thousands of years. And the problem is that in modern thinking and modern science and psychology, people don't understand this. They're completely ignorant of this. It's so weird how people are so dumb about all this, and they are.
Yeah, they are. It's like a forbidden area. Like, I remember when I did that internet survey of Canadian universities, where I wrote to 13 Canadian universities an email, and I said, I'm a student interested in studying the psychology of consciousness, mystical spiritual psychology, or paranormal phenomena. do you have anyone in your department with any expertise in any of these areas? And out of 13 major Canadian universities across the country, there was not one professor who had any expertise in those areas.
Oh.
Now, they would think that some people might have knowledge of consciousness, but right away, those are people in cognitive psychology who have a very limited conception of what that consciousness is. And they don't, yeah. But that was my experience in Canada. Like, this type of research has not been pursued despite its overwhelming significance and importance to the discipline of psychology. It's really shocking. I always saw that as very irresponsible. The modern psychologists have ignored the most profound and central issues to the discipline.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, they conduct what McGuire, a very famous social psychologist, said. He described most psychology experiments as simple demonstration of obvious truths. And I could see that. Just all, you know, like they have psychology experiment where they rate someone on introversion, extroversion, and then study how introverted people speak less in social situations. Like, that would be an experiment they would do, where the experiment is really like self-evident given the definitions employed.
Yeah.
And like so much of psychology is like that. You know, if someone else doesn't, an experiment showing how people don't always have the same level of anxiety, but their level of anxiety varies across different situations, which is something like so obviously true. Kind of, I found so much of modern psychology was just of that bent. It was nothing really of much significance. I want to mention one other thing too, that about when we were studying the evidences on near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences. And what it was descriptions. I think it was in Ian Curry's book called You Cannot Die. But a frequently made observation of people claiming out-of-body experiences, you see that they're still conscious, seemingly. They still have memory and personal identity. They still have thoughts, and they still have feelings, and they can still have sensations. And in the literature, I remember reading one person who kind of said, I felt completely myself.
Yeah.
So what that implied to me, like I saw, wow, this is shocking, because if this is true, that you're out of your body, but you're still thinking, feeling, memory, personal identity, consciousness, and you feel almost exactly yourself, what that suggests is even when we're in our body, that our consciousness and inner awareness was never being produced by the body in the first place. That's why you'd be outside of your body and you feel completely yourself. So what that shows, if that were true, it proves that even when you're in the body, that inner experience and consciousness is not being produced by the body. It's like the living entity inhabits the body, which is exactly what the mystics say. Like that, the body is a vehicle for consciousness within certain vibrational level. So we have a physical body, an astral body, a mental body. So to me, that was very significant. Reading that people describe when they're out of their bodies, they feel almost completely themselves. I mean, there are differences in terms of the lightness, and they can't, the touch, and they don't have the physical sensations of the body, but much of their inner experience is exactly as if they were in the body. I know that really struck me at the time.
Yeah, I remember you always cited that, and I think that's you know, it's one of those things that could be very easily missed, but I think that's absolutely critical because of the implications, as you say, for how we actually do experience ourselves and how our consciousness is experienced. Is that, you know, contrary to what we think, you know, consciousness is not coming from the brain, but that we're never really, you know, it's never really being produced in the brain in the physical body, but that eye experience somehow is descended into the physical body and becomes identified. I mean, and that's exactly, again, back to Adida, he talks about that, is that that's what happens, is you mistakenly identify with your physical body and with the ego, subjective ego, that's who you are. And that's what, you know, that's what your consciousness is and what your being is, but it actually, that's not it at all. That's the illusion of the individual identity. And as you say, in terms of that explanation, that's what an esoteric explanation would predict. Oh yeah, you could be out of your body. You still, you know, you still experience yourself, like you still have, you know, thought and memory and emotional reactions to things. It's your body is not necessary.
Yeah. Another thing, just going back to your experience where you hit your head and you kind of experienced being out of the body, I would wonder, do you still remember vividly, like 40, 50 years later, that experience?
Yes. That happened 40, almost 50 years ago, and I can remember, I can tell you exactly, if we went to Brook Lane Park, I can show you exactly where it happened, you know? I remember it so vividly.
So see, there again, it's not, when you had this experience, there wasn't confusion.
No,
and in a way, it was so, it was so vivid and evidentially real, like seemingly real, that you remember it 50 years later. Whereas, can you remember kind of like that, almost everything else?
I can't remember what happened this morning vividly. You know, there's so many things. You know, I was thinking of, like, you know, Christopher Isherwood had a story or a book, I think, called I Am a Camera, and that sort of was my experience. I so objectively saw this. I saw it so clearly, much more clearly than I remembered it, partly because it was so, I mean, you know, hey, you know, that's me, you know, that I'd never seen myself in that perspective, and I've never, actually I have seen myself since then, out of my body. I had an out of body experience when I was sleeping, where I could see my body in bed. But that was the first out of body experience I had.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think in our lives, if one doesn't have some of these kinds of experiences yourself, I mean, if one has some of these experiences yourself, well, then it really adds credence to it. Like, I mean, I know I've had experiences where I've felt that I was out of my body. And if there wasn't this overwhelming body of other research, which documents, you know, millions of people experiencing this, you might question it more. But when it fits into this, you know, it's like it's not a unique experience. If you did surveys, probably 50% of people have had, I mean, in surveys, over 50% of people claim to have had psychical or mystical experiences of different kinds in their life. Yeah. And especially before, it used to be harder to even admit those things. So, like, you'd find people who had near-death experiences who wouldn't share their experience because they're afraid of people being critical of them, or people wouldn't want to hear their story.
That's exactly right. And I mean, wasn't that in Life After Life when Raymond Moody was giving a lecture and about the near-death experience, and some doctor got up and said that it was all nonsense or something, and his wife raised her hand and said, she'd had an experience. I think it was something like that. It was like somebody, like sitting with somebody else who was denouncing it that had that exact experience. It was like, and then that's the thing, is that it was so taboo to relate so many of these things that people thought they would be mocked and everything, and so they just didn't report it. Von Limmel, in his book on the near death experience, goes into that a little bit and talks about that, you know, that how the self reporting is definitely suppressed about near death experiences, or has been in the past, and how that's changed, partly because it's become part of our cultural knowledge, is that, you know, I think almost everybody of general knowledge now knows about the tunnel of light, you know, and it has some sort of idea of the protocol of a near-death experience.
Yeah.
And that's a, you know, that's a phenomenon that's occurred for the last 35 years, you know. It's a very recent phenomenon. You know, it was funny, too, because I remember my uncle, before this, in the early 70s, had a cardiac event and had died and was telling me about he had been dead. You know, and he was telling me about his experience, but I didn't grasp it at the time. I was sort of interested in the paranormal, so I didn't dismiss it, but I didn't grasp how profound what he was describing was, you know. I wish I'd have taken notes about his, you know, more detailed notes about what happened to him, because, you know, he had that experience when he had cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me, another factor is often the skeptics will say, oh, well, this research is anecdotal.
Yeah.
And implying that if research is anecdotal, it's not valid somehow. Now, which is a completely fraudulent. There's nothing wrong with anecdotal evidence. It doesn't fully establish a case, but anecdotal evidence is evidence.
Yeah.
And people would say, well, you can't produce it in the laboratory, or different people can't produce it on effect in demand in the laboratory.
Yeah.
But the nature of the phenomena is such that it's not applicable. Like, you can't,
nobody
in the laboratory, study the creation of the universe from a singularity. Like, they model it, and it makes intelligible other bodies of evidence.
Yeah, nobody could make meteorites fall from the sky either, and people, you know, dismissed that idea too, that they were real, until they discovered, oh yeah, you know, this actually happens. And so, yeah, I mean, there are varying degrees of to which certain phenomena are you know, can be manipulated or can be produced at will. I mean, there's a big difference between somebody having a precognitive experience where they're able to predict the death of somebody, that a loved one or something, versus somebody who claims that they're a psychic and that they can predict the future. I mean, that's a very, very big, but that's one of the things reading Talbot's book is, there's certainly been certain people who have impressed by their seeming gifts and have been able to demonstrate these things. At least, I think, you know, an open-minded examiner would say the evidence is at least suggestive of this. And it's just too easy to say, oh, they're all phonies and they're all magicians who are producing these effects and duping the experimenters. I just don't think that's credible at all. I think that's ridiculous, you know. There are lots of people who are fakers, you know.
I certainly agree with that. I remember when I was at York, I had a student. I remember I used to collect the Midnight Globes and the Suns and all the tabloids with their yearly predictions.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a student who took, I gave him like 10 years of my Suns and tabloids, and he had to take all the psychical predictions and assess whether in fact those worked out or not.
Yeah.
And he assessed 300 predictions, and out of that, 3 came out of 300. And one of those predictions was that Jerry Lewis would host another marathon for some something. Like they were kind of like obvious things with a high probability of occurring. But it was like all their predictions, like they were just almost uniformly ridiculous and wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not. So I'm also critical of evidences. I think more spontaneous experiences among common folk are much better evidences. I noticed we're just coming down to the hour, the end of the hour. We didn't get to Beelzebub once again, but we'll just continue on, and we'll get to it when the time's right. Thanks, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Listeners, I'd recommend going to my website at zeropoint.ca. And I have quite a bit of writing up there from different books and articles. I recently, Jim, when I redid The Slugs, I've got a whole section now on the processes of reciprocal destruction. And of all the pictures I found to illustrate the chapter, I picked out Pablo Picasso's classic work. How do you pronounce it?
Guernica.
Oh, yeah, Guernica?
Yeah.
And, I use that book in my book, and what it portrays, it's supposed to portray the horrors of war, and it was based on the bombing of a city in Spain.
Yeah.
And do you know where that picture is now?
Yeah.
Where?
Sorry?
Oh, it's in the United Nations. It was donated by Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, because I thought it was in the Rockefeller Collection or Rockefeller Center or something like that. But.
Yeah, it's in the United Nations. And when they announced the war against Iraq, they covered it over. This footnote's in my book. But you know what else? I'd seen that picture for many, many years, but you know what I had never seen in it before? The Illuminati's eye.
Really?
Look in that, and hanging over the death scene is the Illuminati's eye.
Wow.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it, because I'd never kind of realized what that was all about.
Yeah.
Until the last years, I was shocked to see that. Anyway, so
we'll
come back. We'll pick up on the processes of reciprocal destruction next week if we're still around and they haven't succeeded. Okay, thanks, Jim.
Okay,
thanks, BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself. Keep heart. Goodbye.